Welcome to SaaS Open Mic by Chart Mogul. I'm Ed Shelley. Today, we're bringing you a slightly different episode. This discussion is a live recording from our recent Mogul I.O. event in Berlin. It features our own Nick Franklin, founder and CEO of Chart Mogul, and the angel VC himself, Christoph Jans. Christoph is managing partner at Point9 Capital, a highly prevalent VC firm in the world of SaaS and marketplaces. He's made several early investments in companies like Zendesk, FreeAgent, GeckoBoard, and more after he founded a couple of internet businesses in the 90s and early 2000s. The chat between Nick and Christoph covers points like what it takes for SaaS startups today to raise venture capital, whether you should aim to create a moat of defensibility for your startup, and how startups should be using data today. And there's much more than this, so let's dig in. Here's Christoph Jans talking to Nick Franklin.
As some of you might know, we're an early stage venture capital fund. We're this is our office, so we're based in Berlin, but we invest not only in Berlin-based companies such as Chart Mogul, but also invest in companies all over Europe, sometimes also outside of Europe. So we're quite agnostic when it comes to location, but pretty focused when it comes to the type of business model. We're pretty much focused 95% on two things. One is SaaS, which I guess almost all of you in the room here are very familiar with, and the other is online marketplaces. And we're a seed investor. We typically the first investor in a company or the first institutional investor in a company. We were among the first investors at Chart Mogul. And yeah, I guess maybe find out a bit more throughout the conversation with Nick, but please feel free to chime in with any comments or questions as well.
I guess the first thing is I'd like to ask you about is, as there's been quite a bit of change in SaaS has started to mature a bit, and there's been quite a bit of change in kind of investment thesis around SaaS, and including yourself and some of the other people at Point9 have written interesting articles about this. So about the shifting tides of SaaS. So I guess, what does it take for the SaaS startups who do want to go down the VC funding route? What does it take for them in 2018 to get funding, or to at least to become, you know, to get on your radar and to be worth a deeper dive? What are the things here that you look for?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the first and one of the most important things is that I think if you want to raise capital from a VC fund, then it only makes sense if you really have the ambition and the very strong desire to do something really, really big. That's just because of the nature of how VCs work, because of their business model, which you don't have to care about if you don't want to work with them. But if you're interested in raising money from a venture capital fund, then it's helpful to understand a little bit about how how their perspective looks like and our perspective. And it's pretty much true for any other early stage or Series A, Series B fund is that every investment which they make needs to have the potential to deliver a huge outsized return, because so many companies just fail at the early stages. As a rule of thumb, most VCs look for companies that can get to 100 million in ARR and still have a decent growth rate by the time they reach that, so that there is a decent chance that you can become worth hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe even a billion or more. And I think it's a very legitimate question to ask if you want to sign up for this, or if you want to bootstrap and build a profitable company like Smileback, for example, which we heard about, which is a company where it can become profitable, I guess, pretty whenever you want, and you have your freedom. You can go on vacation, hire a managing director. All of this is
Mongolia.
Much more difficult if you have raised a couple of million dollars or euros, which gives you some, like, you sign up for something pretty big and have some responsibility. But obviously, I don't want to discourage everybody from raising money. I don't want to completely destroy our business model. I think if there is alignment of interest and ambitions between founders and and investors. I think it's that is obviously great. And many or most of the largest SaaS companies ever or in of the last decade have gone that path, because if you want to become really big, you usually need more money to invest in the business than you can generate from your in cash flow. And so this is part of like one answer to the question, like what do you have to do or how do you have to look like as a company? And then there are many other factors which we look at, and some of them are in the napkin which I have here in my back pocket, but I think they're lying around
there's
all
pile,
over
there's
too.
A pile here.
This is based on an actual survey which we did earlier this year, where we got feedback from about 60 or so VCs across seed, Series A, Series B, a few Series C. It gives you a pretty good idea of what are kind of like the table stakes or what are the benchmarks in terms of growth, some metrics. For us as an early stage investor, oftentimes there aren't a lot of relevant metrics yet. So by the time a company comes to us with a pitch or like to discuss funding, they might not be Chart Module customers yet, because maybe they don't even have revenues or customers yet. They should definitely become Chart Module customers for their Series A, because at that time you need all these metrics and you need to be 100% on top of them. But at our stage, it's a bit more qualitative than quantitative. So we want to understand the ambition of the team and if they're complementary and the market dynamics and the product and all of that. Yeah.
So how do you think about like the addressable market, the TAM or the SAM? Mm-hmm. And one thing that I always see Jason, so if anyone follows Jason Lemkin and his Saster blog, so the one thing I see him repeat quite a bit is that it's really important to kind of dominate your niche and then to kind of expand from there. And that's something that he advocates a lot. But how does that then reconcile with pitching this massive opportunity? So
yeah.
And also, have you actually seen this play out? How have you seen this play out in your portfolio? Yeah. Are there companies that sort of dominate this niche and then manage to kind of...
Yeah, I think it's probably the right approach for most, not all companies, but for most, to first dominate a niche, because you get all kinds of benefits if you are a big fish in a pretty small pond, because then you get the word of mouth and referrals, because people, obviously, customers and relevant people and talk to each other more if they are closer, if they are have a higher affinity by being in the same market. So you get, it's much easier to get that word of mouth kicking in if your target customers are closer to each other by some kind of affinity. So I think that definitely makes sense. But if you do that, I think then you should know what comes after that and what comes after that. So it should be pretty clear to you how you might be able or how you're planning to expand your TAM by, I don't know, either increasing wallet share of that customer segment substantially or by layering another market segment on top of that or another segment on top or going internationally or into other markets. So I think you have to have a good reconciliation between focusing on something small in the short term, but still having that big plan in the long term. And then maybe the last thing I'd say on this is that some of the most amazing companies in the world didn't have any quantifiable TAM when they started, right? And this is maybe more so in consumer markets than in B2B SaaS. I guess in B2B SaaS, oftentimes you replace an existing software which is on-premise, so you get a sense for the market size. But if you're replacing pen and paper or Excel and Word, it might be hard for you to get any meaningful numbers. And what you can still do is think about the number of target users in your segment and what ARPU you might generate from them, and then you do the math. It's going to be somewhat speculative, but at least there is some rationale behind it.
And I guess another part is sort of being able to, a lot of VCs, when I speak to them, they talk about how you're going to create this moat or competitive advantage. So I'd like to ask, what have you actually, in the companies you've looked at or maybe invested in, have you seen really work in recent years for creating a moat that's actually really effective?
Yeah, I think that's a somewhat funny discussion, because it's also one of these things where there is a bit of a discrepancy between the VC view and the entrepreneur view. Because if I'm a founder and I've been in those shoes, so I hope I can talk from some experience. I think if you are at zero revenues or maybe 500k of revenues, there is probably nothing that worries you less than your defensibility once you are at 100 million ARR. Because you have a million other things to figure out. And the last thing you want to worry about is, how do I become defensible if Salesforce wants to buy me for 500 million? How can I avoid that? So I think from an investor's point of view, you have to ask these questions because you are looking for these gigantic outcomes. And therefore, maybe you should wonder about these questions too as an entrepreneur if you go down that path. But I think you can get pretty far without a very strong moat, which comes from proprietary data, network effects, marketplace dynamics, platform effects, and all these things. I think just having having a great product or the best product, being able to iterate really fast, just having an excellent execution all around the company, I think that goes quite a long way. If we look at, let's say, Zendesk, which is another company which we're both familiar with, I think now where they are at about $500 million in ARR, I think now it's great for them that they have moat, which comes from data effects and this platform and so on. But I don't know if it would have had any impact on like the pre-100 million ARR scale. Yeah.
So I want to change topic slightly. So to an announcement you guys made a couple of weeks ago, I think, where you made a bunch of announcements about being more transparent as a VC firm. Some of you here might have seen this, but I'd like to ask you about what was the thinking behind that and how it's been received, I guess, about publishing standard term sheets and saying that you'll definitely do take part in the Series A and these kind of things.
Sure. Yeah, so it's three things that we announced in a blog post a couple of weeks ago. One was that if a company raises seed financing from us, we basically guarantee you that we will do our pro rata if you raise a Series A. The second thing, and I can give some more details about like the why and so on for each of these. And the second part is we published a term sheet template, which we commit to using. And the third one is we published a simplified due diligence list. Like the term sheet is a two pager. The due diligence list is a one pager. And all of that, the goals of all of these actions are to just simplify the whole fundraising experience for founders, because I've heard it so many times that fundraising sucks many times, and it can be a major pain I don't know what is a microphone friendly body part in the back, maybe. and I think it doesn't have to be that way. Obviously, it can suck if nobody wants to invest. Okay, maybe it sucks, but that's hard to change. But there are elements of why it sucks that can be addressed, and they don't have to be that way. Like term sheets, for example, there's absolutely no point in having a 10-page term sheet with all kinds of complicated provisions for a $500,000 seed investment. This might be a template which some kind of lawyer used for a $100 million investment, and for that probably makes sense, but just doesn't make it's just out of proportion at the seed stage. The same for due diligence. If we were to ask a company like ChartMogul at a seed stage to fill out hundreds of questions over dozens of pages, I just can't imagine what kind of questions could this be that actually make sense. And it's usually what all of these provisions have in mind is to minimize downside risk in incredibly unlikely scenarios. Like if something really, really bad happens, then maybe it would increase our chances to get a little bit of money back, but it basically doesn't matter at all because this is just too unlikely. It's not worth any brain damage on my side or on any founder side. So that was a no-brainer for us. This pledge to the Series A was not a no-brainer. That's something we actually thought about for weeks, if not months, because we know that this could put us in a situation where we are forced to invest in a company that for whatever reason we actually don't want to put more money in. So that is a real risk. But at the same time, We also know that in most cases we want to participate anyway. In those cases where we maybe don't want, because, I don't know, we're not that excited about the company, we would really hurt the company if we pulled back because of that signaling risk. And it's that scenario that founders, that can actually cause quite a lot of sleepless nights to founders, because if they, even if probably the seed investors are going to participate, just having the certainty, I think, is pretty, is quite a lot of peace of mind contribution. And so that's why we're doing it. And obviously we do it because we think it's the right thing to do, but we also think that it makes us as a VC more competitive over funds who offer less friendly terms.
And the reaction, I think it's been overwhelmingly positive.
Yeah, no, we got, I mean, from founders, obviously lots of great feedback as expected, but even from our LPs, which are the investors in our fund, even from them, we didn't get any bad reactions. So they are smart guys.
Excellent.
Many of the founders I talk to spend hours logging into different applications or poring over Excel sheets to understand the health of their SaaS business and get to the root of issues like churn. ChartMogul connects with your subscription billing provider, automatically calculates your key metrics, and turns them into investor-ready reports. As a result, founders can spend less time on reporting and more time focusing on growth. Start your free trial today at chartmogul.com.
So a little bit about metrics now, and a lot of you might know that Christoph is sort of semi-famous in a way for his SaaS metrics spreadsheets and expertise in subscription metrics, and has a lot of resources that you can download from his site, theangelvc.com.
.net. .com is probably taken.
So some of you might have seen this. A lot of this work actually predates ChartMogul. Mm-hmm. So before ChartMogul, this was like the go-to place to get a sort of SaaS metrics, Excel-based SaaS metrics spreadsheet, and start to feed numbers into that. But I'd like to ask a little bit about how your thinking around SaaS metrics has evolved over the years. Like when you created this this spreadsheet, it was like 2010, bit
maybe,
later.
Yeah, I don't recall it.
Yeah.
But a number of years ago.
But it's been a number. So how has your thinking around this domain evolved, and how is your thinking about how startups should be using their data evolved over the years?
I mean, for me, it's always been important to look at metrics for all kinds of probably obvious reasons, right? Yeah, you want to know what works and what doesn't work, and try to fix what doesn't work and double down on what works, essentially, whether that comes to product features and how they are used and how they contribute to customer satisfaction, or when it comes to sales and marketing channels, and you want to know which channels work and what the payback is and all of that. And at a higher level, you want to know if the business is going into the right direction. And so it's always been important for me. But I would say when I started looking into this, there wasn't so much out there. I mean, I didn't invent all of this. There were already other people spending time with all these metrics. But at least at that time, it happened literally on a daily basis that we talked to SaaS companies, and the way they presented their metrics was, at least to us, it was confusing, because there were no standards and like no clear definition. So it wasn't really quite clear what you were talking about. Like, is it recurring revenue, or is it revenue but not recurring, or is it maybe just cash in and it's an upfront payment? So simple things. And I think the table stakes have gone up, in the sense that if in 2018 you're not on top of these metrics, I'm less patient, because I think there's no excuse for not knowing this, because you can Google it, you can Quora it, no excuse for not knowing what metrics mean and how you should use them. And you have products like ChartMogul that make it easy to get the data. So it's easy to cover the basics. And that means you can spend some time now drilling in even deeper and understanding all metrics in a like segment per segment, or acquisition channel per acquisition channel. So some of the things you talked about, which you already do in the product, or which are coming up in the roadmap, they, I think this is where things are getting really excited.
Yeah. And when I go to events like SaaStock and SaaStr, everyone who's venture funded, of course, we're all trying to achieve this exponential growth and some sort of hockey stick growth. But the reality, when you talk to a lot of founders of quite well-known SaaS companies at these events, is it's somewhere between linear and exponential.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
More often than not. Yeah. Sometimes it is like this, but so everyone's always hunting for ways to kind of get it like this. So have you seen in the companies you've invested in, or have some examples of what a company that has gone from quite linear to quite exponential or more rocket ship style growth, and what they did to make that happen?
Yeah. And I think really true exponential growth over longer periods of time is exceedingly rare, because it has, by definition, it has to be viral, right? Like, you have to grow your customers, your new customer wins, literally as a function of your existing customers in order to grow exponentially. That's basically the definition of exponential. Therefore, I pretty much nobody has exponential growth unless you have a viral product like WhatsApp, Snapchat, Skype. It's a handful of them, right? I think maybe the only company, B2B SaaS company, where we've seen true exponential growth is Typeform, because they have this built-in viral loop. Every time you see a Typeform, which is a modern way to ask questions and do surveys online, every time somebody completes a Typeform, they see a little call to action at the bottom, which says, create your own Typeform. So that's a built-in viral loop. So the more people create Typeforms, the more respondents you have, the more people create their own Typeform. So it's a logical viral loop, and they've been able to tweak their K factor or K coefficient by making some small but meaningful adjustments to the product to trigger that virality. In other cases where companies have been growing really fast, I think it's mainly if they suddenly hit product market fit, or if they find that a new channel, sales channel works, or if they can suddenly sell to bigger customers and really increase their ARPA. But I would say it's more like a step change then. Like you grow like this for a certain period of time, and then maybe it flattens out, and then you grow again fast, and then you take the next step. But usually year over year growth rates go down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's very hard to keep them up for a number of years.
So the trick is just to start a viral company.
So, yeah, that's easy.
So Calendly is another one.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's a similar thing where you send the invite out and they see, oh, Calendly, or you send the Calendly book a thing,
and Dropbox is a famous example, or Slack. But it's rare. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So should we wrap up? I was going to ask the one last question. I mean, does anyone have questions here? Okay, let's open up to questions.
Expertise in every data that you bring, you analyze on a daily basis because of your product. So this is what you do. Is there any data that Christoph asked you as an investor and you need to prepare and don't have it instantly?
I think for us, we're getting better now because we have a heap for sort of user behavior stuff. Okay. But like things like monthly active, weekly active users, like engagement stuff, because we're very good at measuring the stuff that CharMogul measures, and not as good at measuring feature uptake and things like this, which so some of that stuff we still have to kind of, we're getting better with heap and some other stuff, but definitely the revenue stuff's okay. the subscription customer stuff, but all the user behavior and the stuff, we're not quite as on it as we should be some of the time.
You guys were talking in the beginning about like bootstrapping versus VC funding, and Kristen was talking about that it's not the right thing to do for every company. I would be interested, Nick, if you would be willing to share a little bit what made you go that way and what led to that decision on your end to say let's do the VC funding.
So I think it's probably a few different reasons. I think I just finished 5 years at Zendesk, where the company grew from like 9 people to about 750 people when I left and gone public. So I kind of felt like, well, now I should do that, right? I mean, it's kind of, it sounds ridiculous maybe, but that was my thinking. I was like, there's these three Danish guys and I've worked for their company and it's awesome for 5 years and now I should try that. But, I mean, we're not growing as fast as Zendesk or I don't think, but, you know, so that was also part of the thought process. and then I think the reason we're able to get investment is because I guess we're also doing this thing where we start in a niche, which is subscription analytics. And now we are sort of expanding to more general revenue and subscription and sort of revenue analytics for repeat customers. And every company should have revenue. So we kind of feel like, you know, as your startup, you should sort of, you get Google Analytics and then you plug in, you get Stripe for your billing or something like this. And then you plug in Chartmogul and you measure revenues. So often we're the first analytics product that any company pays for. So they get Google Analytics for free and they get Chartmogul, they have to pay for it. And so it's kind of, I think there's a very broad market opportunity where most SMBs and even some mid-market, they're just not really getting much value from their data. And so, and it's analytics and BI as a space has not really been like consumerized in the same way that like Zendesk is a good example. They got this space that was full of really cranky old enterprise software, on-prem software from the 90s or something. And they made it into this, you know, well-designed, beautiful, easy to use, low cost solution that anyone could use. And they, by doing that, they sort of expanded the market and analytics is a space where that hasn't happened for a number of reasons. It's happened in certain verticals, like user behavior. There's now a bunch of competing system services, but we think in sort of revenue and subscription and revenue analytics, it hasn't happened. So we think there's an opportunity to build a big company. And why else? Probably also the category of product we are building as well, I think requires quite a lot of investment. Like just to build a Chartmogul product, half our company is engineering. And if you add product and design, it's more than half of our company is just product development. We are still very heavily focused on product development just because of the category of product of analytics in general. And it just requires a lot of engineering and this kind of thing. So I think for some categories, you do need an investment to just have a chance of making something powerful and useful. Yeah. Oh, there was another question.
So I wonder, from investor perspective, how do you look at the companies at seed stage that introduce freemium plans? Should they or should they not?
I think it depends on a variety of factors. Like it depend, like one being like what is the motivation behind that? Like, do you think that each user that uses the product but doesn't pay might eventually upgrade, or is there some kind of virality where you benefit from usage even if it's not paid usage? So I think there has to be a strong reason, right? And then I think it can work for some companies, but at the same time it has a lot of complexities too, right? Because you have to define the paywall at the you have to like weigh like which features are free, which are paid, and typically for 95% of the user base, they are happy with whatever you offer for free. So if you offer too much for free, then suddenly you have to get millions of users just to get a few thousands or tens of thousands of paying users. And then I think maybe it's one thing which is maybe easy to underestimate is the effort to support free users. So they probably shouldn't get any support. They should probably support themselves. Which again then could maybe lead to dissatisfaction, people complaining. So I think it has a lot of pros and cons. So there's no generic answer.
So we introduced a free option last year. Yeah, I think it was the right decision. I think it's not a free option where you can just keep using it. It's not based on features really. There is a little feature differentiation, but it's a freemium model with a hard limit. As soon as you have more than $10,000 in MRR, you get a paywall. It's like, congratulations, you have more than $10,000 of MRR. And then there's like a checkout, like a buy now button underneath it. So it's a bittersweet moment for those guys. But like, it's partly because we figured out that the companies that have less than that in revenue, they also kind of problematic because they're very price sensitive. or that they might go out of business if they're a very early startup or something. And so we figured, like, why not just give it for free to those guys? Take the price discussion off the table, and just say it's free for the less than that. And it's been fine. I think it was the right to sort of wait 2.5 years into the sort of being live. We've been selling the product for 2.5 years for money before we introduced a free version. I think that was the right thing because we'd made the product robust enough that it was mostly self-service. We don't offer customer service for the free users. And also our infrastructure was robust enough where we could add, you know, it took 6 months for the number of free accounts to overtake the number of paid accounts. So we now have well over 1,000 free accounts that are using it. So it's overtaken our paid accounts, and it has negligible, because they're quite low volume on data. So our infrastructure was also in a place where it wasn't going to harm the business, or they weren't going to take the servers down or something if they without even paying us, you know. So it's not like the main driver of our growth. It's a long-term investment. I think we will have to like build up a base of like 100,000, you know, tiny startups or something, and then it will become a significant part. And the other thing is to try and catch the next Airbnb or something, you know, when they're small. And then, because when those guys start as a couple of founders, they have no money. And if it's free, they're going to use your product versus a competitor's product. And then you can kind of grow with them. So it's partly just removing those barriers to entry. All right. Well, thank you, Christoph, so
thank
much.
You.
thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this week's episode, please share it with someone else who you think would enjoy it. Or leave us a rating on the iTunes Store or Google Play or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with the latest SaaS content at blog.chartmogul.com. You can also subscribe to SaaS Roundup, our Friday newsletter where we pick just the top 3 reads every week and share our key takeaways from each one. Thanks for listening.